welcome to the Libertarian Podcast from the Hoover Institution. I'm your host, Troy Senek, and the Libertarian is Professor Richard Epstein, the Peter and Kirsten Bedford Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution, the Lawrence A. Tisch Professor of Law at NYU, and Senior Lecturer at the University of Chicago. Today, the chaos in Portland. And Richard, Portland, Oregon, well known as one of America's biggest hotbeds of progressive activism, has responded about the way you'd expect to the movement of the last few months. The city has been gripped by protests, in some cases riots. There was an attempt to firebomb a federal courthouse. That building has also repeatedly suffered property damage. It's been graffitied. Fires have been set on multiple occasions. And so President Trump has deployed federal forces to Portland, officers from ICE and Customs, et cetera. And this has led to controversy for a couple of reasons. We'll get into some of the particulars in a moment, but let's just start with this. What you've heard from most of the statewide elected officials in Oregon, all of whom are Democrats, but also from a Republican like Rand Paul, is that these are inherently state and local matters, that the federal government just shouldn't be getting involved. So walk us through your views of that as a policy matter, but also the relevant law as to the president's authority to deploy law enforcement in a situation like this.
Well, there's a kind of peculiar irony here. If you go back to the time before 1937, there was a very sharp constitutional distinction between local activities on the one hand and national activities on the other. And it was said generally that the federal government could not reach local activities, which commonly included agriculture, mining, and manufacture. There was always a different rule with respect to cases where federal property was itself directly implicated, because at that particular point, the interest of the federal government and the protection of its own people and its own property was perfectly evident. So the federal government could intervene on those particular grounds, even if it didn't have general plenary commerce power. It's also always been the case that if there's been an invitation by a local government to deal with insurrection or rebellion, which some of this activity probably qualifies for, the president or the Congress can make sure that the facilities are provided in order to do something. So, you know, there's certainly ample grounds, even under the narrowest definition of what's local, for the president to come in for these kinds of targeted responses. The tough issue in many cases is, well, what is it that the president can do if it turns out the states want to disagree with him? And here, the precedent that seems most relevant is the one which happened in 1956 or 57, when you had Orville Forrest breathing fire in Arkansas, and Eisenhower deciding to send in the federal troops in order to secure some kind of order. Similar things, I believe, were done later by President Kennedy in 1962 with James Meredith in Mississippi and so forth. So I don't think that there's any kind of real opposition as a constitutional matter to this. But the politics of the situation today is so completely different. There was a letter that was signed by the mayor of Portland and by the mayor of Chicago and several other mayors, which essentially says, you butt out, we can handle this situation perfectly well. And what they did is they listed a series of federal miscues about appearing in anonymous vehicles, arresting people without obvious cause, and so forth. And their position was, you are only making this worse, so please stay away. What was conspicuously absent from those particular letters was an acknowledgement of the systematic and prolonged attack on federal institutions, and the willingness, apparently, it seems, of these state officials to stand down while these kinds of attacks were going on. And so what you see here is this federal-state situation is now infinitely complicated by virtue of the fact that the state people loathe Trump and are trying to keep him out, and he's trying to assert what I would think would be legitimate authority, perhaps in a clumsy and in a ham-handed way. Who knows which way this thing is going to end, but I think the basic situation is the federal government can preempt under these circumstances, and if Trump decides to send in a larger force, it would be an act of civil war for the state officials to try to say they're going to arrest these people or resist them with the use of force. It's also, I think, a really tragic situation when what you do is you have some peaceful demonstrators, but what's been going on in Portland for the last 50 days is mostly non-peaceful, non-demonstrations, but it's kind of open attack and open warfare. And what you were missing entirely from the governors and the mayors in California and to some extent in Chicago is not an attack on violence as an abstract conception, but an attack on these violent people for these particular violent acts subject by some kind of an arrest. So I think there has been a complete breakdown in local law and order in these particular states. And the president, with his usual ham-handed rhetoric, seems to be making things worse. But I don't put most of the blame on him in this particular one. I think the local governments have just gotten out of control. And I think it's utterly irresponsible for a state official to deny his fundamental responsibility to contain various forms of disorder because of an abiding, almost pathological distaste for the president of the United States. So I see this as a downward spiral going all this way. And I frankly don't see any obvious way out of this situation. I do think that there are a lot of innocent people going to be hurt. I think these cities will suffer some kind of an exodus from various of its citizens. I think their financial positions are going to be hurt by driving away business and tourism. The whole thing seems to me to have an unreal, terrible kind of set of consequences. You're wondering what is going on in this place and what can be done to make it better.
Probably the biggest controversy here, as you alluded to, has been over the nature of the interactions between these federal forces and the protesters. So video has been going around of these federal officers on social media, dressed in camouflage, not wearing name tags or forms of identification, taking people off the street and taking them away in unmarked vehicles. And this has elicited comparisons from some of the critics to secret police. So the official explanation that has been proffered for this is they're not wearing name tags to keep the officers from being a target for reprisals, which is a thing that has happened in some places. They're in unmarked vans so that they're not targeted preemptively by the protesters. But you have stories going around in the media about people who say that while they were protesting, they weren't doing anything illegal, and yet they were picked up off the street and taken to a federal facility. Mirandized, so it's not as if they were taken to a black site or something. But they're saying, you know, we weren't guilty of anything other than sort of wearing the black Antifa uniform. So let me read to you, this is what Orrin Kerr, law professor at UC Berkeley, had to say about this. If agents are seizing people, throwing them in vans, driving them around, bringing them to the courthouse, putting them in cells, and trying to interrogate them over hours, that's an arrest that requires probable cause. Your view on that, Richard?
Look, I think it's much too chaotic to say that. I think what happens is if the question is seizure on the street as opposed to formal charges, there has to be at least to some extent some kind of differentiation. The two rationales that you gave are not simply wrong. If in fact you did put people in uniforms and you put these identifiable vans out there, they would be subject to increased danger. There is no effort on the part of the cities to try to control their own people so as to avoid that, which makes it then sensible to do this. And then it's also, I think, extremely difficult to have the following conversation take place. I claim that I was just there watching. I was not helping. I was not cheering on. I wasn't doing anything. I was just an innocent bystander. That's also an assertion of fact. It could be true. It could be false. But it's you're hearing one side of the story. And now suppose the police come out or the federal officials come out and they say, you know, look, these guys are saying they were that way, but they lunged at me. They started cursing, throwing epithets at me, flashing weapons. You said that some of these people were wearing Antifa or similar type uniforms and so forth. It seems to me under these circumstances, that's a very serious provocation because people like that are in fact known to have used force under these circumstances. And so you're now faced with the eternal problem, which goes back, of course, to this famous case at Assize time in 1663, Tuberville and Stamp. And what happens is somebody strikes somebody else. And the argument is, well, he wasn't attacked. And he says, if I hold back, it may well be too late. And so the great problem that you always get in these cases is, generally speaking, to justify the use of force, particularly by a public official, you do not have to show that there is a direct and immediate attack. You just have to show that it's a very powerful probability or even a reasonable probability. And one is never quite sure of the standard to do this. And if somebody's wearing a uniform of that particular sort, and he's arrested, I have extremely little sympathy with them because they can, in fact, go exactly the opposite way. So what you do is you get the following argument. The public officials have to get out of uniforms to protect themselves, and all of the protesters put themselves in uniform on the grounds that that's their protected constitutional right, notwithstanding the fact that they understand that it's a real provocation. So I would give the police more credit on this. The next stage is once you get them at the police office and you inquire them, I think it would be incumbent upon the public officials to have some independent person listen to what the police officer had to say to decide whether or not it was a bystander or some kind of an activist in these cases. And in some cases, I would let them go without charges. In some cases, I might let them go on bond. In some cases, I might put them into jail. But when you're dealing with a hugely chaotic situation in which all of these people know that everybody else is coming and going, the thought that any individual should say, well, I was there only as a bystander when everybody to the left, right, and front and back of me were active in this situation, but I'm innocent, and they have to be able to figure this out on the fly, I have less sympathy for that than do others. I mean, I think, in fact, what happens is the mayors and the governors should get out into these crowds and say, look, the federal government has come in here. We certainly want to protect your right to peaceably assemble, but nobody can say this is a peaceful assembly of various individuals. And whoever would have thought that that First Amendment question of what does the right of the people peaceably to assemble means when you have some people who are protesting, some people who are violent, some people who are accessories, some people not. If you've got this huge heterogeneous mob over there, I think the edge goes to the government. And the federal government has a legitimate right to protect federal interests, even if it turns out that the president is Donald Trump. And even if it turns out that the local people hate him with a passion, which I find it very difficult to imagine, but which is perfectly evident in this case.
Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who is one of the bigger critics of this in Congress, has introduced a bill in reaction to it that would compel any on-duty agent to clearly display their agency name, their own last name, and their identification number. And it would also create a new oversight process within the Justice Department that would have the Inspector General do recurring audits of this. What's your reaction to that proposal?
Well, first of all, I think it's terrible policy for the Congress to try to figure out under the facts and circumstances of a particular case whether name should or should not be required. I mean, there have been similar situations where my sympathies have again gone. It used to be held that if you wish to make a public pronouncement, people had a right to know who the author was. And then all of a sudden, people find out who the author is and they start stoning houses or sending spam email of an ugly nature to them. And so there's a long constitutional tradition about allowing certain kinds of anonymity as a way of protection. In this particular situation, I think it's just foolish for Congress to think that it could decide whether a president should or should not use this power. I would ask the question as to whether or not she would support that legislation if Joe Biden or some other Democrat were president of the United States. And it also seems to me that there's a serious separation of powers kind of situation. The same kind of issue that you get with the commander-in-chief issue. It's certainly the case that when you are dealing with these kinds of complexities, Congress has some general oversight about the way in which a war can be conducted, but nobody seems to think that the power of the Congress is sufficient to tell the commander-in-chief whether he should use artillery on the one hand or tanks on the other. And this micromanagement gets you into this very nebulous area, but I think the president can make a respectable argument that's saying for the location and the tactics that are used on a particular site, that that's an executive function. It is not in fact, a legislative function, and so they just cannot do that. I mean, and I also would think it would be extremely difficult. Suppose they said, we hereby pass a statute which says that the president is no longer authorized under congressional powers to go in and protect federal property, including judicial branch. We're in really treacherous territory there. There are the famous Steele seizure cases in which you're trying to delimit where the president has power which he could use in opposition to the Congress. And it was certainly held when that particular case, that seizing a mine when Congress had refused to give that kind of authorization in the Labor Management Acts of 1947, that was regarded as simply an abuse of the exercise of power by President Truman. But this is not that. This is a case of direct violence being used against federal property, and I'm not sure at all that Congress can tell the President of the United States that he can't protect the judicial system or other federal officers under his command. So I always think that you want to get these branches to work these things out in advance because this is such a gray area. But once you see that Trump is involved in this situation and Ms. AOC is involved in this situation, there's just no common ground between them, which is one of the deadly consequences of having the extreme polarization that we observe in the United States today.
Final question. I'll refer here to an editorial that ran in the Wall Street Journal a few days ago, because this is representative of a debate that's happening right now, especially with all these things occurring in an election year. The final paragraph of this editorial on what's happened in Portland reads as follows. We understand Mr. Trump's desire to restore order, but he's also saving Democrats from themselves. State and local Democrats will blame federal intervention for any and all disorder, deflecting attention from their own failures. The media will echo whatever they say. Progressives run Portland, Chicago, New York, and other cities now experiencing a surge of violence. If they want to indulge the mayhem, then let them live with the consequences. Close quote. In other words, fine, have it your way. So, Richard, would you accept that argument, or does a president have a duty to interpose in circumstances like this, even if he's going to be hated for it?
I am very uncomfortable with that kind of argument, which strikes me as being super pragmatic. Progressives may run these cities, and they may have even 70-30 majorities, but you know, there are a lot of people who are going to be hurt. There's stores, there are going to be lootings, there are going to be damages, and so forth. And it seems to me that you cannot use majoritarian thinking when it comes to the protection of individual rights to bodily integrity and property protection, and that if the states fail in that particular function, the fact that a majority of their citizens are cheering this on would be terrible. So suppose what we were to say is to go back to the South and it's 1960, and it turns out that they, you know, these are the segregationist people. When they do is they engage in terrible attacks on black individuals within the area using violence, and the federal government is coming in. They say, look, you know, these guys have to really pay the consequences at the state level. Just let them stew in their own juices. I would not accept that argument, and I would not accept that argument even if every black person in Mississippi in 1962 was given the franchise. So no, I do not agree with the Wall Street Journal. I think they're being much too political about this situation. And so what you do is you get this situation where the president sits there and he rails and he moans and he says all sorts of things that you want to reject. But on the actual ultimate question as to whether or not federal authority should be used to restore order to protect federal property, federal offices, and even state individuals and state property, when the state governments refuse to do something, I think he's in the right. And what's so striking about all this is you see what's going on there. And long before the federal government went into this situation, it turned out that the police were standing down. I live in a building in the city of Chicago, and it's boarded up on the ground floor. And the reason it's boarded up on the ground floor is that the store windows were broken right along and near Michigan Avenue. And as best I can tell, when from people who were here at the time, the mayor had ordered the cops to stand down because she was supporting Black Lives Matter. I think that that's an impermissible departure from your fundamental duty to take care of all of your citizens. And I think what's really happened is many of these mayors now regard themselves as partisans in a value, when I regard them in their acting in their public capacity as having a duty of care which they owe to all the citizens, not only those with whom they agree, not only those who voted for them, but with those who disagree with them and so forth. This is a country of majority rule, but it's also a country of minority rights. And the elementary protection of bodily security and of property security seems to be something that every local government has to supply. And if they willfully don't supply, I don't think they should be respected. And indeed, if you look at the letter that they wrote, what they said is that the president is making things worse. What they never bothered to say is they had made a complete mess of the thing before he came along to make it worse. There was no defense of their own decision. There was only the statement that, well, he has come in there and he's made it harder for us to work. Well, it's easier for them to get on the right side of this. The way in which they ought to do that is they ought to take law enforcement back and to put it into their own hands, not worry about autonomous zones, not worried about allowing these settlements to stew for a long period of time, not allowing people to come out in provocative clothing where the threats are perfectly implicit, not driving ordinary citizens into their homes. This is a terrible situation. The president always is ham-handed. I never wish to defend him on grounds of tact or diplomacy. But I think on the constitutional issues, he's got a lot more right on his side than people on the other side. And when you hear people like Nancy Pelosi calling the federal government stormtroopers, when they're trying to protect people rather than to kill them strikes me as a genuine perversion. It shows just how far the political process in this country has gone astray. This is, I think, a harbinger of things to come in the future. I've never been more pessimistic about political governance in the United States than I am now, and I was a fully sentient adult during all of the unrest that took place in 1968 and so forth. This is much worse.
You've been listening to the Libertarian Podcast with Richard Epstein. Remember, you can read Richard's column, The Libertarian, at Defining Ideas at hoover.org. And you can also follow him on Twitter at Richard A. Epstein. And if you enjoy the show, please rate it on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. For Richard Epstein, I'm Troy Senek. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution, where we advance ideas that define a free society. For more information about our work and to hear more of our podcasts or see our video content, please visit hoover.org.